While the world waited, Saddam Hussein systematically raped, pillaged, and plundered a tiny nation. No threat to his own. He subjected the people of Kuwait to unspeakable atrocities. And among those maimed and murdered, innocent children. While the world waited, Saddam sought to add to the chemical weapons arsenal he now possesses an infinitely more dangerous weapon of mass destruction, a nuclear weapon. And while the world waited, while the world talked peace and withdrawal, Saddam Hussein dug in.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Hard Brexit, soft Brexit, or no Brexit at all. Brussels says no to every offer Brexit Secretary David Davis puts forward. So whatever happened to Brexit? A proposal the Tories make to Brussels is rejected. Is it inevitable there will be no deal? And with such a situation, will Theresa May's minority government be able to get Parliament to pass required laws, including repealing the European Communities Act, to implement the referendum? As the most direct threat yet to the very existence of the EU, will Jean-Claude Juncker take Brexit lying down? Also, the police progress report this week on the pre-election Manchester Arena terror attack, with thousands of staff investigating. We have a look at what they've found so far about the bomb that killed 22 concertgoers on the 22nd of May. Plus the 7/7 London bombings, 12th anniversary today. Victims' families were distraught, waiting up for 2 weeks to hear the coroner had the bodies of their disappeared loved ones. And several years later, the inquest disaster, and how then too families were treated appallingly by the Secret Services and by the judiciary. Our sister show Dialect is here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, WikiSpooks editor Robin Upton explains how he discovered big corporations and the Secret Services control Wikipedia. Also, musician David Mowat on next Thursday evening's performance, looking at 100 years since the Christian Zionist Balfour Declaration, which created Israel. That will be taking place at Henley's United Reform Church next Tuesday evening at 7. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect, or if you can't wait, you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. Way to discuss before all that to discuss Brexit amongst other things. I'm joined on the line now, I hope, by former MEP Richard Cottrell. Hi Richard, welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine. Can I just say
before we go too far into this, there was a discussion earlier on Bristol Metrobus. As the former chairman of Advanced Transport for Avon, I would like to chime in on that subject if I'm permitted to do so.
Go for it.
Without a shadow of doubt, the Metrobus project is a disaster. There is no example in transport history of people who use cars by preference finding themselves willing to travel by bus. It doesn't matter what you call the bus, they just don't do it. It's called modal transfer. The whole point of modern transit systems is they are trams. Trams carry thousands of people. Buses carry hundreds of people. But what's astonishing about this extraordinary project is its cost. And I would ask a question here, and perhaps you can take it up with the necessary authorities. What are they up to? I have a suspicion that the huge amount of engineering which is being put into the Bristol Metrobus project is, in effect, a preparation for converting the whole thing to light rail transit in the none-too-distant future. Will that do to stir things up for the moment?
Well, I hope so. Why do you say it's so expensive? I mean, surely costs have gone up since you were doing that job. Anyway.
If we'd been permitted to finish the job, we'd have had a 40-mile system running in Bristol at the moment, and it would be less than the cost, which is now being paid.
Okay, can you tell us about the timing and what was being planned at the time for Bristol with trams?
Well, basically, Bristol had trams until the Germans dropped a bomb on the main depot opposite the old HTV studios and destroyed the whole system. Or it was allowed to destroy the whole system. So a citywide network, I can't remember the exact amount of miles, but it was large, was simply put to the axe. It was just closed down all at once. And Hitler got the blame. And to a certain extent, we can agree that probably he didn't know he was doing that, but he did it just the same. The ATA project, Advanced Transport for Avon, was actually my idea. I cooked it up while I was working for HTV when I noticed the immense amount of what I would call spare railway lines hanging around the place, which no one was using. And I suggested to a number of people that they could be connected together and made into a citywide transit system, which, as you know, has happened in many other cities in the UK now. You can go to quite large cities, and the first thing you'll see is a tram going down the streets. Now, this was the great mistake. I think it's a pity, because I read day after day, when I look at the Bristol Post, of the appalling traffic chaos and jams which are seizing Bristol up, transport sclerosis. This is bad for people. These are fumes. This is global warming. This is destroying the city environment. All that happened, and I'm not going to go into names here and pack drill like that, a lot of people got very jealous of this interesting experiment, which we did not ask to be paid for by either the ratepayers or by the government. We were going to raise the money ourselves, and we did. We put the first bill through Parliament, which would have connected Portishead to the city centre. You're still waiting for Portishead to be connected to the city centre. How many years later? Nearly 30.
Now, Richard, what about Brexit, though? Because I know you actually sat for several years as a member of the European Parliament for the Conservative Party. And you've seen how this works or doesn't work, Brussels, from the inside. What do you make of whether we made the right decision in the referendum or not?
Who's we?
The British people.
The British people didn't make the decision to leave. There was a narrow majority in favour. This is the thing that we forget all along. If there was a singular national issue, which was, shall we say, decided on the same margins, I think there would be an uproar. The difficulty is that a large number of the people who voted were voting against the Tory government for disconnected reasons. A large number of the people who voted have never had anything to do with Europe in their lives or even been there. A large number of the people who voted were not informed on what the consequences would be of Britain withdrawing from the world's second largest economic market. For Bristol, it is a disaster, an absolute disaster. There is no other way of looking at it. We are being asked to disentangle ourselves from the single market, which was created, by the way, by Margaret Thatcher. It was driven through in my time in the European Parliament in order to dissolve the barriers between member states to allow goods and people to move freely.
Actually,
it was a brilliant
Richard,
idea.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it wasn't. It was actually drawn up at Philips Electronics under Visa Deco, who was the chief executive of Philips Electronics. It was them that actually drew up the single market. Did you think it's right for companies like Philips to be drawing up our legislation?
Well, I don't accept that's correct.
I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
Okay.
The thesis, which has pulled that whole thing apart, and in fact it's got statements for the people that actually drafted the single market.
So what you're saying is, if we unplug ourselves from the great big warm bath called the single market, we'll all live very happily ever after.
I'm saying it was drawn up by at Philips Electronics, not by Margaret Thatcher.
I don't think that matters a jot. I think what matters is that we have spent all the years since 1945 trying very hard not to have another scrap between European families. And on the whole, it's worked out pretty well. We kept away from it. We created a system which you and I and everybody else can move around Europe as freely as we wish. We've created a system in which there are no customs, no barriers, nothing between trade and trade between the member states. Since everybody else in the world is looking for freedom of markets, the UK is in the only position, is in the unique position of being the only country in the world that doesn't want to be part of a free market. And it deludes itself in thinking that you're going to get a pat on the back from everybody in Brussels so that you can, you know, commit suicide quietly in a corner.
Well, actually, it's not crazy. Suicide, is it? Because yes, we've got both Switzerland and Norway are in the European Free Trade Area. There's no reason why Britain couldn't be in that too.
Yes, Finland is the size of Devon, hardly that. It has no financial services industry. It is not an exporter in any way whatsoever.
Norway.
And it's not a member of the European Union, but it is a member of the European Economic Area, which gives it more or less many of the same benefits that a full member state has. And by the way, Finland has to contribute all the costs that it otherwise would as a full member state of the European Union. Switzerland is a different case altogether, and we don't want to get into too many technicalities dividing Switzerland, Finland, and the other core group nations. But the simple fact of life is, if at this stage of our economic development, we propose to slam the door on our largest market, I call that crazy.
What about Theresa May? Because she's in a bit of a bind, having called this general election in order to consolidate her power with a very high poll rating at the time, now to find that she's running a minority government. Who is this woman and why is she still there?
Cruella de Vil. That's the best name I can give her. She's the most hopeless prime minister, I think, in studied history. We'd have to go back to the 19th century to find somebody of her inept judgment. One can say that, in a sense, it's cause and effect, isn't it? Because the referendum in the first place was sanctified by an old Etonian, David Cameron, who has little or no, and never had any real contact with ordinary living human beings, except the drunken clubs that he belonged to at Oxford. This was about his personality. It was about his feeling that somehow he had to leave his mark on history. He thought he was another Harold Wilson. It was Harold Wilson who called the first referendum, and Harold who said, this will settle the matter for a generation. And these were the thoughts that were running through Cameron's head. Hey, I can do the same. I'll be praised as a hero. I've put this boiling, horrible vat of mess out of the way, out of British politics for the next 30 years. But when Harold was holding his referendum, there wasn't a Nigel Farage. And this is what really made all the difference. What came out of the referendum campaign was a lot of nastiness bubbling up from beneath the surface of the British state. Fear of Johnny Foreigner. Feeling of everybody across the ditch, the moat, is after us. Feeling of taking back. Taking back what? The whole point of the European Union is that everybody shares. We all get the goodies. Nobody's taking anything back from anybody at the end of the day, except now a load of debt and loss of markets.
Well, you say everybody
shares, drive this home,
Richard.
There will be immense loss of markets, and it will affect
Bristol. You're saying everybody shares, Richard, but of course the distribution of jobs and industry is not equal across the EU by any stretch of the imagination. You know, in fact, you can see some countries like Germany doing extremely well out of it, other countries like Greece crumbling.
Yes. I don't think you can compare Greece and Germany. What I can say is this. Personally, I think that what the EU did to the Greeks is little short of political rape. But this is a different matter. It isn't about EU politics, it's about banking politics. And it's about huge sums of money which Greece was persuaded to borrow by Wall Street banks, which, as it turned out, they couldn't later pay back. This is the Greek crisis. And this is specific, nasty, unpleasant thing. But it does not devalue the value to ordinary people of a single market in goods and services, freedoms of people, which represents part of the great sort of, how shall I put it, renaissance of Europe after 1945.
Well, it's easy to say that, but you see, for Greeks now, looking at, for example, the vote 2 years ago, wanting to come out of the euro, that was pretty much rejected. They look upon the euro now as a kind of noose around their necks.
Well, who looks upon the euro as a noose around their necks? The Greeks, yes, because they have been, I'm sorry to say, stuffed. But this is not EU business. This is propping up banks business. This is propping up Wall Street banks business, who, by the way, cooked up this whole rotten scheme, which has crucified the Greeks in the first place.
Anyway, look, let's get back to Britain and Theresa May. What faction in the Tory party does she represent, if any?
Herself. She also represents the backwards boys. And all political parties are coalitions. There's no such thing as the Conservative Party. There's no such thing as the Labour Party. There are factions within those parties who are either supreme at one time or losers at another time. Mrs. May's faction is rather like a stray dog, I think. It doesn't have any actual home. It doesn't actually have any loyalties. It doesn't know where to find its feeding tray. She is inept. She's incapable of making strategic decisions which give anybody confidence in her judgment.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, let me just bring you in here. What do you make of the fact that Theresa May is still there, even though she's got really very, very little, if any, credibility as a politician because of her disastrous decision to undermine her own majority in the general election?
Well, I don't think she's going to be there in 2020 if there's an election in 2020. And, of course, if she goes before then, it's quite possible that she'll be gone either by internal coup or just through losing a general election. She doesn't look very good, does she? I mean, I think, as Osborne quite rightly said, she's a dead woman walking.
And, Richard, what do you think is her future? Richard?
Ah, what do I think is her future? Zero. None. Absolutely nothing.
So who do you see sort of moving in and taking over? On what faction? Is it going to be a Brexit faction that's going to take over now from her?
The main faction, which is in some way in command of the Tory party at the moment, is around Hammond, without a shadow of doubt. If I were to say that the proverbial London bus carried away our beloved Prime Minister tomorrow morning, I think he would be the next Prime Minister, and I think he would reverse Brexit.
Also, we've got various, I mean, there's been several over the last few weeks, overtures made to Brussels saying, for example, you know, we want to allow people who are resident in Britain now to stay here if Brussels will allow British residents who are residents, say, in Spain, etc., to stay there. And this has been simply thrown back in our face, apparently.
Well, I speak with some knowledge of that because I'm a British resident of Italy, and it's generally known that you can't just walk into Italy, you know, set yourself up. You have to be given within 3 months a specific what we call certificate of residence. And I and my family, my wife is Polish, we all have this certificate of residence. It's permanent. It can't be taken away from you. You can convert it into Italian censorship at any moment of your choice, which is probably what we will do. We have two daughters who are dependent on us. So there's a lot of hype about this, which isn't really very well understood. The threat to British residents abroad is much smaller than is being pumped up at the moment. It wouldn't affect me, for instance, and it wouldn't affect thousands of other Brits who are resident in Italy. You have to remember that artists, painters, poets, and goodness knows who else, like Ernest Hemingway, for example, have been living in Europe for centuries, and nobody ever kicked them out. So it's not quite as simple and straightforward a threat as everybody's presenting it to be. Where I am worried is that Mrs. May constantly harps on this theme that anybody who is involved in something foreign abroad, outside the UK, becomes a target. For instance, she wants to withdraw from Euratom. This is insane. But you know why she wants to? Because it has a large number of foreign scientists, and she wants to keep them out of the UK. There's a form of insanity about this. And I did send you in an email earlier today that I think there's an explanation for this, and it's not a very nice one, which is that we are going into the same kind of politics which wrecked Germany between the wars. The Weimar Republic was destroyed by a conspiracy of forces which eventually led to dictatorship by Hitler and which eventually led to the Second World War. Most people think I'm alarmist on this subject, but I'm not. I believe that we are in a position where the United Kingdom unless it reverses Brexit, unless it gets a hold and a grip on what the real world is like, is going to slip into that awful abyss of Weimarization followed by dictatorship.
Well, why was it so easy to join the European Union and not so easy to leave? Surely, I mean, if we're in any kind of democracy, then whatever the people decide, that should then take place. And it is effectively mainly around who writes the laws. And that's what many people voted on, the whole sort of thing of sovereignty. I mean, obviously, immigration too. But that was the main reason, I think, is to do with us being part of this kind of United States of Europe without us ever actually being asked.
Well, how many times did we ask? Churchill wanted to join the early formation of the European Union. Wilson called the referendum so that we would stay in it. Thatcher never for a moment suggested it was sensible to leave the European Union. It was actually very hard to get into it. We spent the best part of 30 years trying to squeeze open the door. So you can't say that it's easy. There was a lot of things to decide.
Sorry to interrupt.
A lot of law to
be
passed.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there because, hang on, because Thatcher, she was ousted because she wouldn't sign the Maastricht Treaty, which created the European Union. So we're talking about two different things here. It was the common market before that. She was happy to be part of that, but she didn't want to sign away sovereignty.
No, she, John Major did that task for her.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, so all I suppose I'm saying here is that there was that whole business around the, I think it was 1992, 1993, Maastricht being signed, where what we'd actually agreed to join in the 1970s was changed without there being any kind of popular vote and popular approval for it.
Yeah. Now, the Maastricht Treaty is one of those things, right, like sort of something out of Sherlock Holmes, really, trying to find out what it's all about. It's perfectly true what you say, that Mrs. Thatcher went through a whole series of struggles with her various ministers of finance on this whole question of a common European currency. This was the issue, and it's called the give an inch, take a yard argument. Will we all end up with the common European currency, which was called the euro at the time and became the euro? It was simply a sorry, I got a cough. It was a question, really, of how the UK would react to losing the pound. I don't think that there was ever a possibility of losing the pound. But the Maastricht Treaty said something else. It didn't say you've got to be submit yourselves to the euro. What it said was we are looking for a common means by which we can control inflation throughout the whole of Europe. And Mrs. Thatcher was willing, in many ways, to sing that song. There was a great eruption in the Tory party afterwards, which very nearly split the party over Maastricht. But it was amazing. It was an issue, really, as I remember it, because I was very much involved in it, which was so heated at the time. And yet about 3 weeks later, everybody had forgotten about it. And the reason was that it did not actually change the position of the United Kingdom whatsoever. It recognised what other people wanted to do.
Now, the chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, says that free trade deal is really off the table for Britain, and he's been saying that literally within the last few days.
Yes,
that isn't really negotiating to say that there won't be any kind of free trade deal, whatever you do, is it?
Well, it depends what the negotiations hope for their purpose. If it is that you want to leave Europe and then creep in by the back door, I think that's a very convincing position, is it? It's not exactly logical. You want to say, I take back control but I want to stay in the common movement area. I want to stay in the free trade area. I want to stay in the customs zone. I want to share in all the contracts that you're making with other countries. Here's a very good one today. This is in the news. The EU has just signed a new trade deal with Japan. This is a very important development. The Japanese are not the easiest people to deal with in trade negotiations, and I've had some experience of that. Britain is outside that deal. She will now have to make a completely separate deal with Japan. And I wonder how interested the Japanese will be. It's much easier for nations to go in as a group to make trade deals. And you can't have some kind of, you know, a menu a la carte. You can't have a nation which says, I want to have this, a bit of that, a bit of something else.
Well, yes, you
what
can.
You do, you what can. You do is on inside of the shop.
Yeah, but you can,
there you
can't
do
you?
Your bargaining.
Yeah, but you can, because it's called the European Free Trade Area, and it includes Norway, it includes Switzerland, it includes
Liechtenstein.
You've got
to go on about this.
Well, I know, but this actually means that it means that the Norwegians and the Swiss can trade with other parts of the world in a similar way to EU countries can, and it's a kind of halfway house.
Because they signed a treaty which is identical to them being members of the European Union.
No, but it's not, is it? Because they're not governed by the European Court of Justice, as you know, and or by the EU institutions. But they do have to pay.
Yeah, but it's a huge amount. I was listening on the radio yesterday to the Finnish Prime Minister, who said, "Well, it's very interesting that you want this deal, the Finnish deal. you'll find it turns out not very much to your advantage." They pay, I can't remember the figure now, but it's large. They pay a huge sum of money to be present in those areas, which are the two main ones, of the European Union. But it's not a free deal, and they're not going to give. And I can tell you, the EU is not going to give it away.
Richard, where are we going to be in 2 years' time? What's your prediction?
Up the Swanee. Quite literally, up the Swanee. I say this for other reasons, by the way.
Splendid isolation, is that what you're talking about? Splendid isolation?
No, can I finish what I'm going to say?
Of course.
Look, there's another big recession coming. And this one is going to make 2008 look like a birthday party. There is a massive slump on the horizons. Already, house prices are falling everywhere in the UK. We're facing a situation where immense industrial change is taking place, which is shaking large numbers of people out of their jobs. We can call it, if we want to use a cartoon phrase, robotization, but it is happening. Do you realize that the average income, value in income of a British worker has fallen by 22% since 2008? There is no gain in wage rewards. Austerity sacrificed large numbers of people to the dump, to the bottom layers of society. And this is where Brexit will assist, like throwing a bucket of water over a drowning man. We are going into a slump.
And is that going to be, if we decide we change our mind, we're not exiting the European Union, is that going to help then?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because who's going to do the asking? The Labour Party aren't very clear on this. And let me say there that I'm quite an admirer of Mr. Corbyn. I think he is an extremely impressive man. And I think he is a system breaker. But I think that when it comes to Europe, something goes on in his head which stops him from thinking logically about this. I say, and everybody will say I'm a doomsayer, and just because I was a Euro MP, I got paid huge salary, therefore everybody must revere the European idea, because I don't actually agree with that totally. What I'm saying is, if we are not going to have, if we're denied access to many fundamental aspects of the European Union, which I believe will be the case, then where are our political leaders going to be then? It doesn't matter who you are, whether you're bouncing Boris, whether you're Theresa May, the parson's daughter, or whether you're Mr. Corbyn. It doesn't really matter, because they will have to try to pick up the mess. But what I'm trying to get across to people who are listening to this now, there isn't a simple frozen world out there. It isn't going to stay like you're looking at it at the moment. There is a huge crash coming.
Well, you mentioning Mr. Corbyn, I know he is going to meet the European Union's chief Brexit negotiator, I understand, Michel Barnier, for discussions in case there is a general election. The Labour leader said things could change quite quickly and we will be ready for it. He's going to sit down with the EU's chief Brexit negotiator ahead of any snap negotiation. Said the meeting would allow him to outline Labour's approach for Brexit, for the EU's frontline negotiator with tariff-free access to the single market, the party's main objective. He also said he would set out Labour's support for the UK unilaterally guaranteeing EU citizens' rights and maintaining similar consumer, labour and environmental regulation. So what do you make of Mr Corbyn's move here? Is he, do you think, going to actually get a better reception at Brussels than Theresa May?
No. Definitely not. The Eurocrats I talk to, and my former colleagues, of course we're all in contact with each other. It's a sort of little club. We don't think it'll make any difference. Corbyn's position is really no different than Mrs. May's, which has already been rejected. Now, I understand that Mr. Corbyn has a particular problem here. Namely, he's got his, shall we say, Western Front, which is committed to non-Brexit. And then he's got the traditionally sniffy side of the Labour Party, who always regarded Europe as a big bosses club. And to a certain extent, I'm not going to deny that it is. But when you're, you know, in the shed when the roof's falling in, you want to be sure whose company you are in at that time. I'm saying that it's not possible for the UK to leave the European Union and survive it. I don't think so.
What about the cataclysm you're talking about? I mean, we certainly, in the first hour, we were talking about the collapse of the property bubble, for example. Are there any ways, do you think, politically or as individuals, we can stop that happening or make it less horrendous when it does?
Whistle. Keep your spirits up. You can't stop it. There is a seismic change coming over the world. You don't have to look at the UK or Europe in particular. But the United States is heading into a very, very deep depression. The state of some countries in Europe other than our own is difficult. I live in Italy, and I can say that looking around, there's a general fear that there will be serious developments which affect Italy's ability to make her way in the world. When you get into that situation, you want to be under the same roof as everybody else. You don't want to be out on your own. You don't want to be, you know, going down in Nelson's flagship down the channel, shouting boo at everybody who passes by. You don't want to lose Waterloo instead of winning it. You don't want to lose Trafalgar instead of hanging on to it. No, this is not a sensible approach. This whole thing was brought about by the bravado, the boastfulness, ignorance and stupidity of David Cameron. He did it for his own purposes and his own means, exactly how he's lived his entire life and his short, fortunately, political career. The whole thing has now been dumped into the hands of the nanny, who doesn't like changing nappies. That's where we are.
Yeah, but Richard, I'm looking for a bit of light at the end of the tunnel here. I mean,
there isn't
surely...
any. There isn't any.
No, really?
I haven't mentioned that the world is drifting towards the Third World War at the same time, but it is. The tensions which are rising now between the nations are extremely reminiscent of those in 1914 and 1939.
In what way?
War. The confrontation between the powers captained by Captain America and the powers captained by, for the sake of it, call it the East, but this is a stupid geographical term, two powerful nations, China and Russia, is reaching pressure cooker point. And at some point, it will blow. There are too many threats going on. There are too many wars going on, which are caused by Western meddling, almost totally. I live in a country which is bringing in something like 20 to 30,000 boat people every month, every single month. The majority of them are coming from Libya, a country which was smashed to pieces by David Cameron's humanitarian bombers. Now the Italians are saying, when are you going to start saying, taking some of our refugees, instead of us all having them here? We've got troops on the Austrian frontier now. Nobody feels at this stage that there is a common need to solve this problem, because they don't want the Muslims. And it's far more complicated than that. But we've got to understand that if this situation is going to be solved, then it has to be done on a communitarian basis, because I don't see any single isolated member of the European Union solving this problem by themselves. And David Cameron caused this problem, and before that, Blair, with his insane invasion of Iraq, which he's still trying to lie his way out of.
I mean, it's interesting, you know, you being in Italy there, because and countries like Greece as well, having to suffer this massive influx of refugees and migrants coming across the Mediterranean. It almost seems as if it was orchestrated in order to put pressure on the kind of basic social services of Southern Europe.
Well, my wife and I do what we can for the immigrants here. I can only say that I can only praise the Italian people for how they have reacted. The Italians are not traditionally very good at welcoming disparate cultures, but this time it's different. And I was very impressed by the head of the Italian Navy, who was interviewed the other day about the Navy saving people from the sea. And he said, "We are men of the sea. We know our duty." So it's amazing, really, how what should have been a very divisive issue, especially here in northern Italy, where I live, close to Venice, where we have the powerful Lega Nord organization, we actually have a situation in which the amount of, shall we say, aggressive reaction to this large number of immigrants is so far being blissfully few. Partially, I think it's the Italians themselves, who are an extremely nice people and not inclined to be horrible to anybody who's turned up. But I think it's also a question of attitudes. If you can, if you want to, you can. You can do it. What we can't do here, and I suppose I'm speaking increasingly as an Italian citizen, what we can't do here is take everybody.
One of the whilst talking about this geopolitical stuff, of course, it's the G20 meeting at the moment.
Yeah.
Now, I wonder what you make of today's first meeting, allegedly anyway, between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump.
I don't give a damn. It's meaningless. It's stage theater, stagecraft. There's nothing behind it.
Well, I mean, if you're talking about confrontations, global confrontations, surely these are the two people that, if we bang their heads together, can stop that kind of thing.
Who's we? These are the two most powerful men, one of the three most powerful men, because Xi in China is the other one. There's no way in which these theatricals of all these great summits of G20, G43, G19, G2, it just doesn't matter. It's all sham hot air. It's meaningless. And Trump is bonkers anyway. So it's extremely difficult to try and negotiate with a man who's probably recently discovered where Russia actually is and who its president is. This is a man who's lived his life basically in reality television. And he's continuing to react and drive his presidency as though he's still on the TV. There's no possibility of these stupid summits coming to any reasonable attitude about anything. What you have to do is make positive decisions. Stop scrapping in Syria would be the first one. Stop threatening Iran. Give Israel the sense of security that she needs. Stop the war in Afghanistan, which has been going on for the lifetime of my teenage daughters. These are the things which need to be done, which are concrete. You have to curb the power of the Pentagon, which is running United States, independent of the presidency.
Well, that's
you have to curb the power of the deep state. This deep state operates in all countries.
I mean, well, you're painting the US as the protagonist in most of these aggressions around the world. It almost like, you know, we're part of this evil empire now.
Well, I don't think that America is an evil empire as such, but she could stop calling Russia an evil empire, because I think this kind of abuse, saloon bar abuse, it's meaningless. Each country has its strategic interests. Each country has its strategic hopes. They try, sometimes, to actually work out things between themselves. But we have to accept that it was American interests that wanted to overthrow Assad in Syria. I say nothing for Assad. He's just a creep. But in trying to upset the delicate balance between the Sunni and the other factions of Islam has caused a huge civil war problem, which is eventually going to blow up in everybody's face. This world is armed to the teeth with missiles. We only need a false move in Korea to find ourselves up against a war with the Chinese. We're all teetering on this brink. And then we have HMS Britain. Oh, did you see this lovely story of this aircraft carrier? We have no aircraft to put on it, by the way, which should be called HMS Sitting Duck. The age of this kind of imperial bravado and chest banging is long over, but we still can't stop ourselves doing it. So presumably we can all sail around the world now saying how powerful we are. And this is the kind of hubris which has got behind all of our political systems, and not just in the UK. I'm not saying anything that I think Russia, which is a country I know extremely well and been there many times, hasn't got a lot to answer for. We all do. What we are all forgetting is that we have been here before. We're roughly in the position of Munich, the Munich Agreement now, where everybody's going to try and make a deal which will fall together 3 or 4 years later. We only need one of these sodding missiles to escape accidentally from a silo, and they're all very old now, 50 to 60 years old, some of them. We always need one of those out, and that's it. Lights out.
We've been in that situation for a long time. But anyway, we're going to have a look at the Manchester, the police's report this week on the Manchester terror attack. Richard, I wonder if you'd like to stay with us to discuss that.
I wouldn't mind, but I don't know that I can contribute too much
we'll
to
see,
that.
We'll see what you have to say, right. Because we're going to hear now from the BBC's reporter, Nick Garnett, from his report, which was really just telling us all, I suppose, what the police have found out so far about what happened at Manchester.
Yeah, okay. I'd very much like to listen.
The inquiry won't be over anytime soon, they say. The focus is primarily now concentrating on one simple thing, questioning the bomber's brother. Hashem Abedi is held in Libya at the moment, where he lives, but there's a problem. In Libya, there is no single authority in control. It is therefore very hard for the police in Manchester to get access to him. Talks are going on to see if it can happen, but when I asked if police from the UK had travelled to any other country as part of this investigation, I was told simply no.
So the prime suspect, Martin Summers, they can't interview him because they haven't been to Libya.
Well, also, the suspect's father was arrested in Libya, I understand. Well, what does arrest mean? He was taken away by somebody. But as he was taken away, he said, my son is innocent, and he's a known member of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. And they have been working quite intimately with MI6 over the years. And I know Richard is quite knowledgeable about Operation Gladio in Italy and elsewhere. And, of course, the suspicion is that these Islamist groups, particularly the Islamic Fighting Group in Libya, are, in fact, deeply entangled with our intelligence services.
Richard?
I could best make a comment there by saying that it has been shown that many of the fighting groups who are active in the Middle East are in fact in, shall we say, financial betrothal with Western powers. The difficulty is you have to try and sort out one from the other in this case. I think it's the situation in Libya, which is we're specifically discussing at the moment in respect of Manchester. I don't see how anybody is going to solve it. I understand what the police are saying. Who are they going to go and talk to in Libya? Who's going to cooperate with them? You have a situation where the families will always say, my son is innocent, or whatever. Unless you have a full, proper police open investigation into what is going on, and the ability somehow, I don't know how, but somehow to try and deal with people in Libya, it will be extremely difficult to move forward to pin down the culprits. This is simply a matter of detection, which is the job of the police force. If they can't do any detecting, how do we move forward?
3,200 people form part of this investigation. At one point, 1,300 counter-terrorism police officers had been drafted in from other parts of the UK to try and help with this investigation. It's a massive thing. What they have found is a lot of different bits of information. They understand now that Abdullah, who is a convict in Altcourse prison, was visited by the bomber twice. He was sent to prison for trying to aid people travelling to Syria in terms of trying to carry out acts of terrorism. So a link there. But the central link that we were being told about was the investigation into what happened in Libya. There doesn't appear to have been anybody working in a concentrated form over here, no network as such, but it is inevitable that he was getting hold of supplies from certain places. And so, no, there was no network, but others were complicit in the way that they possibly helped or knew what Salman Abedi was doing.
So he's saying it's a kind of lone wolf, Martin, no network here, everything's in Libya, but we can't go to Libya.
Well, I don't necessarily believe that. I think there's very overwhelming evidence that the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group have been based in Manchester since the 1980s and Operation Cyclone. The Libyans were the cutting edge of the people infiltrated into Afghanistan by our own security forces and intelligence services in that era. And we've still got lots and lots of people from that era resident in our towns and cities who have an intimate relationship with the intelligence services going back to that era. And I don't know whether we'll ever get to the bottom of this. I agree with Richard, it's quite unlikely. But I think people need to understand the general pattern here. We know that the Western intelligence services set up the Islamic International Brigades to fight in Afghanistan in the 80s. And the story is that they then went off the park and we lost control of them. But the fact is that in Libya and in Syria, in very recent times, British intelligence and military personnel have been intimately involved with jihadi terrorism. I don't think there's any dispute about that.
Oh, we'll go back to Nick Garnett again, finally.
The bomb was homemade. It wasn't military. There were photographs that were leaked in the days after the attack that showed what looked like very, very militaristic types of hardware, the detonator button that was published in a newspaper in America. The police here say that it simply wasn't. It was a homemade bomb. It was in a tin with shrapnel around it. The shrapnel was nuts that he'd bought from a local shop, but the devastation was huge. The pot mark on the floor that had been being gouged out of the concrete was absolutely massive.
Well, 22 deaths from a homemade bomb. We were told at the time immediately with various experts, Martin, that the bomb was definitely military explosives.
It's actually quite difficult to make homemade bombs. The IRA got very good at it in the end, and I still think that there's a question mark about what the Libyan connection here. And I think the police, I dare to mention it, they may be being misdirected by the intelligence services.
Yes, a strong possibility.
Anything more to add, Richard?
Well, I'm listening with great interest to what our fellow contributors are saying. My concern about these explosions, these incidents and these events, is what follows afterwards. What is the trail that we follow? We follow the gradual and erosion of our civil liberties. We are living increasingly in a Big Brother state, where every single phone call we make, every single discussion that we have online, even what we talk about and say when we're in the streets, on public transport, are being recorded. We are in a situation where democracy is slipping away by the second, not just the minute. And I should like to remind you that the authoress of the 1984 state in the United Kingdom is none other than our present Prime Minister. Every time there is one of these incidents, horrific incidents, there is a loss of civil liberties afterwards. And I find that it's impossible to disconnect one from the other.
Well, we'll finish with an interview which aired on Sky, which doesn't look as if anybody seems to have looked into this. I don't know if any of these thousands of police have done. And that's from Kirsten Pollard. She was interviewed by Sky, but it's an interview which has pretty much sunk without trace. And she points the finger of blame, actually, at the private security firm who were actually supposed to be looking after people at the Manchester Arena that evening. So let's have a listen to her now.
We sat down in our seats to start from the beginning. We had somebody sat next to us and looked very suspicious. She was fidgeting all the time with a bag on the floor across her. She was by herself.
What was she doing?
She was looking in the direction of where the explosion actually happened all night and smirking to herself. I got suspicious myself, and my friend said to me, who was actually sat next to her, directly next to her, said, "I don't like this." She was fidgeting with her bag and the zips and on and off, hands in the pockets. It puts you on edge.
What did you do about it?
I told security, who then informed a higher security. They were up and down the stairs where she was sat, discreetly watching her. I knew what they were doing. Nothing was actually done about it. And then later on, as the concert was going and Ariana actually came on the stage, she was getting more and more agitated. The bag was then on the floor and I actually sat next to her and I actually nudged her arm intentionally so I could actually speak to her. I said, "Oh, sorry about that. Are you by yourself?" And she said, Yes, and she spoke to me, but I didn't understand her.
You were worried enough to talk to security.
Yes,
they listened to you, although you say that they didn't really do anything.
I don't think security did listen to me.
Then what happened?
Because then my daughter got very upset about things, Holly, and she went to security, and they basically told her, how would you like it if someone accused you of this? We'll look into it. And nothing was done about it.
And then, of course,
the concert went on. This lady was more agitated. 1 to 2 minutes before the concert finished, this lady disappeared. And then, of course, the explosion went off in the other end of the stadium.
And what can you remember of that? What did you see?
Oh, it was just a huge boom. I never saw no smoke, no flashes or anything. They were trying to blame the balloons, because there were some large helium balloons, but the boom was too big. It was too big. It couldn't have been a speaker, because the music had finished. Arianda, she'd gone off the stage, so then everyone started screaming and just charged to the nearest exit. Up the stairs, it was a stampede, it was absolutely horrendous. People were pushing me, we was just running and running, and fortunately our hotel is just 5 minutes away, so we ran and got into the hotel. But it was just absolutely horrendous, and the security was awful. I'm sorry to say that the security did nothing about it, and there should have been more security. And we walked through the doors when we had our tickets, and they scan your tickets, and we wasn't even checked. They never checked bags at all. I never saw them check anybody's bags.
Richard, finally, I know you've written a book on terrorism, and there's somebody there with an interesting eyewitness report that doesn't seem to have been investigated at all by the police.
It does seem that way. I listened to it with great interest. It was a very detailed report by a lady who obviously has the gifts of watching things closely. The only thing I would say is that in the subsequent, if you look at things after explosions like this, lots of people have lots of similar experiences of seeing people who were doing something serious. But I think the main point is something suspicious, I meant, rather than serious. How did this material, shall we say, equipment, how did they get it into the stadium in the first place? There was supposed to be massive security. We've had lots and lots of these scares, and worse. And yet it seemed so easy for whoever they were, the bombers, to get into the building and then cause the carnage that they did.
But there has been a history
somebody
of
looking
this,
the other way.
I mean, you've written a book about this. Tell us about your book.
Well, my book examines the causes of terrorism, and it apportions terrorism to genuine terrorism. It's a terrible phrase to use. To, shall we say, natural homegrown terrorism, people with a grievance against one state or another, and different kinds of terrorism, which are invariably staged by state organizations in order to produce a situation in which people will accept ever more draconian restrictions on their civil liberties. There are two mixtures here, if you like, together, and they can actually be one and the same at the same time. This, the name Gladio comes from a secret army organization which NATO organized after World War II. They're called the Sleeping Soldiers, and they were meant to stay behind in the event of a Russian invasion, and then they would sort of leap out and bomb the Russians and do nasty things to them. And eventually, since the Russians didn't turn up, the whole thing was turned to political violence, which in Italy here, which was on the receiving end of it, was known as the Anni di Piombo, which is the years of lead, which led to the sacrifice of Italy's great Prime Minister, Aldo Moro. It eventually led to attacks on Pope John Paul II. We're looking at a whole series of complex political issues, the use of terror for political ends.
Just what's the title
Zorro's
of the book?
The Hills. It goes back to Sun Tzu in China.
What's the title of the book?
Gladio. It's called Gladio, NATO's Dagger at the Heart of Europe. And it discusses and explains, it doesn't make me anti-NATO, by the way, but it discusses and explains the activities of rogue elements of NATO, the secret soldiers, the sleeping army, who got out of control and turned to political violence.
OK, Richard Cottrell, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show. And it's time pretty much now to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi and Yusuf. Thanks to our guests in the first hour. That's Green Councillor for Clifton Down and Building Safety Consultant. No, he's not actually. No, he'll be on in a couple of weeks. That was Clive Stevens, and former UKIP candidate and pornography producer John Langley, also Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This show's story links and comment page is onewordthisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1986 with Alpha Blondie. Do please join us for The Politics Show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Para filmar. Why pam 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 kawere.